Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to another Rahalastava Book Club. I'm very excited to welcome a previous Rahalastava guest. It's Professor Alice Roberts, who'll be talking about a brilliant book, Buried. Hello, Alice.
Hello. I'm glad you like the book. That's lovely.
Oh, I love it. Well, look, I loved the Ancestors book, and I love this book. Let's talk briefly about the many, many books you've done. I mean, people probably know best of all your proceedings of the 6th annual conference of the British Association of Biological Anthropology and Osteoarchaeology.
That was a good one.
But that's what you're most known for. But you've written, is this your 12th book, Buried, or do you keep count?
Yeah, it's getting tricky actually to keep count of them because there's some which I feel it's not really right to count as two books. Like I did a big illustrated anatomy book for Dorling Kindersley, but it was anatomy, physiology and pathology. And then they pulled out the anatomy bit and then published that on its own. So there's complete human body and then there's complete anatomy or something it's called. And I thought, well, does that count as another book? Because it's actually the same book.
Yeah, you've got to count it twice.
Okay, well, it's probably 13 then.
Okay. I don't think you can count the hardback and the paperback, but I think if the name's different.
Yeah.
You can trick people into buying extra ones. I did mention it on the podcast before. I think the first book of yours I read was The Incredible Human Journey, which I enjoyed greatly, I think we said this on the other podcast, it's research has moved on quite a long way, even in the 10 or so years since you wrote that book. And so there's quite a lot that's changed in the...
Yeah, a lot of it still stands up to scrutiny. Yeah. I wrote that in 2008, which is when we filmed the big series of Incredible Human Journey, which went out on BBC Two in 2009. It was my first big landmark series. And it was obviously meticulously researched at the time. But there's a massive omission now, which is that we didn't have any idea in 2008 that modern humans and Neanderthals interbred and had babies together. And now we know they definitely did. So that's quite a major omission.
That's pretty big. And there seems to be more every time I read the news about this. There seems to be an extra. Oh, and people came out of Africa a few more times. Yeah. And we found another group of people that came out a bit earlier. But it's still the same basic exodus point is the same. The main exodus point is the same. But there may have been a few monkey men jumping out a bit earlier.
Yeah, well, absolutely. There must have been, because we get we've got like Homo erectus evolving, we think, in Africa around 2 million years ago. And then they very quickly pop up all over the world. And I say we think in Africa because actually the earliest Homo erectus fossils that we've got in Africa are about 1.8 million years old. And we've got some from the Republic of Georgia, which are also around 1.8 million years old. So I think that's there's a little bit of a question there about where exactly that species originated. It could have originated perhaps in Western Asia. But yeah, certainly it wasn't just an African story for those earlier species as well.
But in a sense, it's the exciting thing about archaeology, I think, and is, that we can find, and this is what the current book is really about, but A, we can find out this amazing stuff about things that happened so long ago, but also it's open to reinterpretation and also new discoveries, which is exciting, really.
It's really exciting. I mean, it is a science. So science is evidence-based, and as more evidence accumulates, you adapt your theories and your hypotheses. But I think what we're seeing now is that we've got the broad brushstrokes, and we've had the broad brushstrokes there for a while. So, for instance, if you look at the origin of our own species, we're absolutely sure that our own species, Homo sapiens, evolved in Africa. And there are different strands of evidence that come together to support that. So not just the fossils, but also genetics as well. Hmm. So we're pretty sure about that. You know, there's always levels of reliability and kind of robusticity of results in science. There's some things that we can be incredibly sure about, like the fact that the Earth goes around the sun. And then there are other things that we're, still working out the details of. So I think we've got a lot of the broad brushstrokes of human evolution. And we know of about 20 hominin species. So those are species that are more closely related to us than they are to other apes, going back from, sort of 5 million years ago through to the present day. And what's odd is that we're just the only ones left. And it was quite a bushy tree of different hominin species. And then there was just this one little twig that carried on to the present day and was ridiculous.
With a little bit of Neanderthal in us, though.
Yes.
And some of us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's true. So even though it's kind of single species that's carried on to the present day, we have incorporated bits and pieces of other species in us. So not just Neanderthals, but these mysterious Denisovans as well that we know from DNA extracted from bones in Siberia too, which is really peculiar because we don't have a whole skeleton of them. We don't really know what they look like. We've only got like sort of finger and toe bones, the occasional tooth.
Maybe they were just a tooth on the end of a finger. Maybe that's what they were.
That's it. Just hopping around.
That's how they ate with a tooth. Good, but you've got to keep an open mind, Alice.
Absolutely, Richard. Good luck with that one.
I'm glad you're... Well, look, I've listened, both of these books, Ancestors and Buried, I listened to the audio books. So I listened to Ancestors last year, I presume it was, which is... They're together, really, these books, aren't they? So the Ancestors is the prehistoric burials, and Buried is burials... I always want to say Anglo-Saxon, but I know from reading the book that I better not say that.
It's really tricky.
From the first millennium of Britain is what it says, on the front cover. I like the books as a pair, though I think they are quite different in flavour. I thought Ancestors felt like you, because obviously you're picking out really star burials from throughout history, and so they were all kind of almost celebrity burials in archaeological and historical terms, whereas Buried feels much more like a sort of your personal journey with the work you yourself did, as well as some very impressive burials as well. But so there is quite Buried feels like more of a personal book to you. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I suppose Ancestors is a kind of, I've said this at the beginning of both of them quite unashamedly, they're not meant to be textbooks, they're not meant to be comprehensive surveys of British prehistory and then history. I've picked out burials that I know something about, which is always helpful when you start writing a book. And ones that I'm, you know, kind of interested in, and I think cast light on the kind of the wider time, the society that these people lived in, that kind of thing. But you're right. I mean, with Buried, it was an opportunity for me to go back to some skeletons that I've looked at over the years and actually reboot a bit of research too. So that's what's quite interesting, I think, about writing these books, is that I'm not just kind of writing about the science once it's happened. As you write about it, you go, oh, hang on a minute, I better go back and check that again and do a bit more research. So I'm actively working on some of the skeletons in those books. And actually that's the same for Ancestors too, where I include a bit of a story about some of the skeletons, some of the skulls that I'm looking at from Pitt Rivers Estate on Cranbourne Chase. But the other big difference, of course, between the two books is that Ancestors is all about prehistory. So you're accessing the past only through archaeology. You've only got the objects to look at. And then once you get into history, so once you get into the first millennium, you've got some written material as well. And I describe that as a blessing and a curse, because it's amazing to hear all the names of people and to hear all these details, and, you know, particularly from Roman literature. But it draws the eye and it draws your attention so much. And I think what you have to do is treat the archaeology on its own. It's a bit like a forensics case, actually, and I've worked in forensics cases where you don't, when you're working on the human remains, you don't want to know anything else about the case. You want to be completely objective about what you're looking at, and you just want to draw information from what you've got in front of you and then give that to the police. And it's really important, actually, that you don't know anything else about the context of the case, because that could potentially colour your interpretation of the evidence that you're looking at. And I think we should be approaching archaeology in the same way, so that rather than going, oh, here's the history, let's see how archaeology illustrates that, or here's the history, let's see how archaeology provides more evidence, we should be going, well, let's put the history to one side. What does the archaeology say? And then bring in the history to create the bigger picture and the bigger context.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, and also, of course, the history is still very, very sparse from these times. Either things haven't survived, or certainly a lot of those post-Roman times in Britain, there was not much being written. You know, priests and stuff might have been writing a little bit, and we weren't getting much stuff from other people.
Yeah, I mean, I still use the term the Dark Ages, which obviously my friend Yanina Ramirez would completely throw up her hands in horror about. But we do have this kind of pit of, you know, suddenly this void of literature in the kind of 5th and 6th centuries, where we don't really know what's going on, and we certainly don't have as much detail as we did in the Roman period. But having said that, the Roman period is really patchy, and it's also it's another way that history kind of skews our view of the past, is that it's a lot of it is military and a lot of it is to do with administration. And we're not really getting at the lives of ordinary people in Britain. You know, we do a bit elsewhere in the Roman Empire, but not so much in Britain. And there are people writing about political events in Britain who've never set foot in the country. So it's really tricky. Even though we think we've got masses of literature about Roman Britain, that it's actually quite patchy. I mean, even Hadrian's Wall is, I think it's only mentioned once. It's, you know, it's a kind of passing, it's like 15 words or something about Hadrian's Wall in the whole of Roman literature. And you kind of get this impression that there's a lot more and there isn't.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's really, I feel this, the Buried is sort of more of a, you know, it's like, it feels like a little love affair with how archaeology works, because it's sort of intrinsically fascinating how much you can discover about the past from relatively tiny clues. And obviously that's with DNA and everything, that's expanded out a lot more in the last few years than would have been the case before that. But, you know, within this, it's just learning from bones and teeth and grave goods. But you also go into obviously language and place names and sort of putting this jigsaw together and then combining that with DNA. But it's a meticulous and long reaching project to do it, but it's a sort of very exciting that science can bring to life so much from the past that would be forgotten because it's literally not written about.
It's amazing, and it's and I think that what's really interesting is that people are, you know, increasingly working in really big teams with lots of different expertise coming together. And the archaeogenetics is just transformative. It's really amazing. And I am I mean, hopefully Buried has whet your appetite and you think, oh, it finishes, you know, at the end of that first millennium. Surely there's more. So I'm currently writing the last book in the trilogy, which takes us into the last millennium, where I'm really focusing on pathology as well, which is what kind of drew me into this area to begin with. And I did my PhD in paleopathology, as you know, Richard, because you've read it.
Yeah.
as you revealed when I previously did the Revelistifer podcast. And the way that that's been transformed by genetics is just astounding, because we can now extract not just the DNA of that particular individual, the human DNA, but in there will be any DNA of any pathogens which they had on board. So so it's, you know, it's just extraordinary. We know, for instance, as I talk about in Buried, that the Justinianic plague of the 6th century, which we have good documentary records for ripping through the Byzantine Empire, we didn't know whether it reached Britain at all. We didn't have any evidence. We didn't have anything written about it. There's a couple of kind of passing things, something which I'm not sure anybody else had picked up on, actually, in the Book of Llandaff, where there's a story about a bishop coming back to West Wales. And it mentions a pestilence. And I wondered whether that was actually this Justinianic plague. So I think there may be kind of subtle hints at it in the literature. But what we've got is more than a subtle hint in the form of actual Yersinia pestis, plague pathogen DNA from 6th century cemeteries now. There's one that I mentioned in the book. And since the book was published, we've got several more. So we can see that it's, you know, right across Britain, basically. So the plague does reach British shores in that 6th century.
Yeah, I just find it's sort of unbelievable that you're able, I mean, it's such a wonderful thing about science and archaeology that is possible, that something that specific is possible to actually, you know, find out about and actually have a solid fact, basically. I suppose that's what this book is, though. There's some really interesting, I was very interested in the early burial discovered with the pipe coming out of the coffin, which is something, you know, you wouldn't think of, and then working out why that is and what that means, and working out why that happens.
I was fascinated by that. I mean, that was a cremation that I looked at some 20 years ago, and I was looking at a whole pile of cremations from Caerleon, the legionary fortress in South Wales. So it's really important because it's one of three big legionary bases in Britain. The other two are Chester and York. And there was a town that kind of grew up around the fortress, and it was in its kind of heyday in the second and third centuries. And cremations were fairly normal at the time, but this one was just extraordinary because it wasn't just buried in the ground or in a pot in the ground. It was in this lead canister with a pipe going to the surface of the ground. Yeah. And I remember when I looked at this burial, I mean, cremations are, you know, really tedious to to analyse, because you've just got this pile of very tiny bone fragments. But, you know, you've got stuff that you can identify some of the time. But I kind of felt with that one that I could conclude that there was one individual in that canister, and it was an adult. And it might have been a man. And that was kind of the limit of my scientific contribution. But I was much more interested in the style of the burial and what that was about. And there's one other known from Britain, but there are lots of them known from other places in the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And some of them are pottery and some of them are lead. And it is connected with the Roman tradition of graveside feasting. So presumably what you'd do is go along on one of the very many Roman days of the dead. They seem to be quite obsessed about this, going back to graveyards, not just on a single day of the dead each year, but on multiple ones through the year, and have a feast and celebrate with the deceased person and give them a little tipple down the pipe. I mean, that is just extraordinary. I really loved that. And then I had this really bizarre moment on a dog walk with my friend Natasha, where I was telling her about writing the book, and I said, oh, this amazing pipe burial in Caerleon, and I think it's to do with graveside feasting, how curious. And she said, she comes from Siberia, and she said, oh yeah, we do that. And I said, what? And she said, yeah we do it. She said every year we had to go to the graves, and there was a specific day called Parents' Day. And you had to eat food, and the adults would all be drinking vodka, And it was, we were all told as children that, you know, we had to join in with the feast. That was what happened at the gravesite. So I thought, well, that's extraordinary. And she sent me some information about it. And I started exploring that and found out that it was a tradition in the Russian Orthodox Church and the Greek Orthodox Church, so the two big branches of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I thought, well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because those go back to the Byzantine Empire. And actually, Parents' Day itself seems to be the original Roman, one of the original Roman Days of the Dead, called Parent. Right. It was called Parentalia. We've got the literary evidence of this. So it's a ritual which goes back to pre-Christian Roman Empire, survived through Christianity. So Christians just adopted it. The Soviet Union tried to obviously get rid of all religion and rituals, but this graveside feasting continued, and with a kind of reinvigoration of Christianity in Russia today, it is all done very openly. Although reading some of the websites from the Russian Orthodox Church is quite interesting, because they frown upon excessive merriment. So you can have your feast and you can do your drinking of vodka, but just, you know, all things in moderation.
But it's amazing to find those. I mean, it sort of is amazing and it isn't amazing, because you obviously that's how humans work, but to find these connections to the past. But all of us, I think you might even basically allude to this or say this in the book, we are all been brought up by a parent or a parent figure who has been brought up by a parent figure, and that each generation will pass things down. So, you know, we're all in this never ending chain.
Yeah.
That is a parent to a child, parent to a child, beyond humanity and back to. So a lot of these myths and a lot of the, you know, even the things, the way we act with our families and the things we talk about, some of them must go back hundreds and hundreds of years, and maybe even more than that without us knowing, maybe some of the unconscious cues and stuff. So it's fascinating to see it when it actually you can actually progress it and it hasn't been destroyed by regime changes and wars and is still going on in different places. I think what I love about your writing is that it does, you know, your books are certainly academic and you feel like you're learning stuff from them, and I think obviously the research is all there, but you're very much a part of the books, and they're written in a very Alice Roberts style, and we get your person, which isn't always the case with history and and scientific books, that I think you're sort of a character within your own books, and we get your personality, but it's there's a chattiness to it,
yeah,
that I think brings in the reader as well. You know, you talk about your partner, your husband, and your own life in there as well as the, which I think is lovely, because again, that is, you are part of history, Alice, you know, eventually.
Yeah.
So it's, you'd like to know more about the historians of the past, which you do get a little bit in their histories, but is that consciously, are you writing consciously with an idea, I want to get a mass audience, or is this how you would write?
I think it's just how I write, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very lucky that readers like it, and I get lots of nice comments from people on Twitter saying that they really enjoy hearing my voice coming through in the writing.
Yeah.
It certainly makes it a lot easier when you do the audiobook as well, because it's like, I've basically written for it, for me to read out. You know, that's kind of how I write. And I think, I suppose over time I've probably become more comfortable doing that. I think this is probably much chattier if you were to kind of compare this with Incredible Human Journey, which has still got a lot of experiential stuff in it. I was writing it as I was filming that program, and so there's a lot of conversations with experts in there, and then a lot of experiential kind of travelogy type content as well. But I think I probably have become much more, not relaxed about being conversational, but much more comfortable doing that. And also quite robust about, you know, because I will get the occasional reviewer saying, oh, you know, it's not very academic. And it's like, well, you know, what do you mean? Do you mean turgid? Do you mean I should be writing in a more, you know, sort of florid or turgid way, and a less conversational way? In which case, I would disagree with you, and I think my readers do as well.
Yeah, there's a snobbishness to that, but you want to educate people, so being entertaining and being a human being, I think, is part of that. And you know, and as I say, I think it doesn't feel like the content is dumbing down in any way. It's not like you're you are very kindly, if it's an area that, you know, people aren't an expert on, you will lead people in and remind people of the facts. And I like very early on that you explain why you're using BCE and CE just to avoid people writing into you. I know that's why you do.
Yeah.
just so I will explain that they've been going for a long time and it's fine, which is lovely. But you know, that's the actual work, the actual research and the science of it is I would consider it an academic book, but it's one that, I know, I remember being at university and reading history books and turning off, and you know, that was what I was meant to be doing as a student.
No, no.
So to you know, to draw people in is not a bad thing, and to entertain people, it sort of is a weird snobbishness about the way things are supposed to be, but you know, I don't think it's a good way to impart information.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Talking to you, I've listened to both of them in audiobook. I do have them both as books as well, because there's some lovely pictures that are well worth seeing, and it's nice to be able to read them as well. When you're doing your audiobook, with this one, did you regret putting in all those Celtic names of places? There's a whole... there's about three pages where you're just saying these very difficult to pronounce Celtic words.
No, it was really, really difficult, and I did have some help with that, because obviously when you write it down... you go, well, that's fine. I've written it down, and I can write it and make sure that it's correct. But as for pronouncing it, and it is really tricky. I did have some help with that, which was fantastic.
It's a beautiful portion of the audio, but you do pronounce them very. I don't know if it's correctly, because I don't know how to say them, but you say them very beautifully, and it does make it sound very magical.
No, I hate to say. I mean, I had a really lovely interaction with a linguist in Scotland, Michael Bauer. He helped me enormously, and you know, sent me himself reading the words that I needed to pronounce, but then actually demanded that I did a Zoom session with him because he said it's actually a lot about the shape of your mouth, and you have to watch me doing it, and I have to watch you doing it to make sure that you're doing it right, and that's much better than just listening. So he was absolutely fantastic. So yeah, that was a bit of a bonus getting a tutorial in Gaelic pronunciation.
Yeah. I've just written a book, and I was in mind of the audiobook, and occasionally I go, oh, I don't know how to say that word. I'll change it to something else that I know that I'm comfortable with saying. I know how to write it down, but God knows how you say that. So yes, there's a little bit of history in my book, and I'm thinking, oh God, I've got to work out how to say all those Persian kings' names or whatever it is. But never mind. I mean, you know, there's because it's the subject you're dealing with, because it's dead bodies largely, it is, you do have to sort of step away from, to up to an extent, from the tragedy, the human tragedy that obviously all these people have died. I know there's a chapter about infanticide and that you give some trigger warnings with, which is all well and good, but it's it is that sort of, it's a And you're saying you were just, I think, either about to become a mother or just become a mother when you were researching that part.
Oh, yeah. So that was the very first series of Digging for Britain, and which was interesting in itself because I was thinking about doing the series and then I was pregnant. And so I spoke to the executive producer and said, I'm pregnant. And he said, oh, okay. Well, you know, maybe we can work together in the future. And I said, hang on a minute. I could still do it. And he said, really? And I was like, well, I think, you know, I could do it. I could bring my baby with me. I talked to my friend Miranda Krestovnikov, who was a fellow coaster. We both presented Coast back in the day on BBC Two. And I knew that she'd taken her babies filming with her. And so I had a chat to her about it. And she said, oh, yeah, absolutely. They're completely portable. You can just put them under the table. And in a chair, in like a, you know, car seat, not just under the table. And I thought, well, okay, it might be doable. So John Farron was up for it, and it was absolutely brilliant. And we had a lovely time doing it. So I went off with my husband and this tiny baby. I think she was about 5 weeks old when we first started filming. And the very, very first story that we were covering was this story of infanticides. And I hadn't really thought about whether it was going to be tricky, which is, a failing on my part. But I was there unpacking all these little boxes full of tiny little infant bones and laying them out. And I was suddenly quite kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, this is quite close, and this is quite close to the bone for me, so forgive the pun. At that particular time, I was able to kind of maintain my professional objectivity and just get on with the job, but it turned into a really interesting project. And that was one of these interesting moments when research turns into television, turns into research again, because as I was looking at these infant bones, I noticed cut marks on them. And they'd not been noticed before, so that turned into a whole research project in its own right. And we ended up writing a paper on it. And with my friend Kate Robson-Brown at University of Bristol and Simon Mays of Historic England. And we think that it's probably evidence of Roman obstetrics. So we think that it's probably, it is dreadfully sad and really gruesome, but it's probably a fetus which has been dismembered in order to save a mother's life, actually. So maybe obstructed labour and then dismemberment of a fetus. So it's subjects that I was keen to just include, well, my own story and my own feelings about looking at those bones at the beginning as part of a warning that that content was there in the chapter. And there's this really weird thing going on at the moment around archaeology, I would say, not in archaeology, where some people are getting aerated about trigger warnings. Now, trigger warning is a relatively new phrase that's come along decades in the two disciplines that I'm most heavily involved with, anatomy and archaeology. We've recognised that it's actually very good to be sensitive and not do what happened to me when I went to medical school, which is basically to throw me into the dissection room on the very first day of medical school. Go, here's a knife, get going then. There's a dead body, on you go. And we're much more, not delicate, but just thoughtful about that introduction of mortality, of talking about death, of actually experiencing death in that way. And you don't know what's just happened in people's lives, you know, so there could be somebody reading my books who's just lost a baby, or, you know, you don't know what's going on. So I think it's really appropriate to say, this is what this chapter's about. You might at this point in your life want to skip over it. And I don't think it's just bizarre. So there's this stuff going on.
It's a weird thing to get upset about, because it's not really hard, unless you think, I haven't got time to read two sentences apply to me.
It's really odd. So there was a criticism, there was a freedom of information request to universities, and there was a criticism of a university course where there was a warning about that kind of content, about content around human remains in it. And I think the Daily Mail covered it and said, oh, this is so woke. And it's like, it's not, what does woke mean? It's just being sensitive. And it's kind of
people,
normal.
You know, as we're seeing, as people, I mean, this is all part of history as well. People don't like things to change. They like things to be the way they were. And it is sort of, when you actually come down to all these things, you go, well, it's just being slightly thoughtful about someone else for a second. I mean, is that so bad? So yeah,
it's really odd, isn't it? It's like, we don't want you to behave like that. We want you to be deliberately cruel.
But you know, I think it's very good to give the warning. I suppose we've also given the warning as well, hopefully. But as a scientist and as an archaeologist, you know, you need to do that. And it is actually a fascinating chapter about birth control in the past and all these things you wouldn't necessarily think about that wouldn't, and you know, and how one would have had to cope with those situations where a baby is not, you haven't got modern medicine and there's no other way out of the situation. You have to choose that awful situation. You know, it's good to realize those things because we live in a society, hopefully, where those things are very rare and obviously they're happening in places in the world though. So it is fascinating that I just find it amazing. You can learn so much, excuse me, from something like that. And just, you know, you noticing that detail.
Yeah.
Just sort of spins everything around as well.
Yeah. No, it is interesting. And I think it was interesting to write about infanticide and also to, there's been this kind of ongoing debate about how much infanticide actually happened in the Roman world and, you know, whether it was used to skew gender, you know, whether you were you know, getting rid of more female babies than you were male babies, for instance. And also the idea of infanticide as effectively a late abortion because there's no safe abortions. And I think that's all, you know, that's all very interesting. And also there's a high rate of infant mortality in the Roman world, so that something like a third of babies were unlikely to make it to their first birthday. So it's quite a shockingly high rate of mortality compared with what we see actually around the world today. But then I did put that in context of it as well, because there's huge variability, obviously, around the world. And the other thing to say is that we can't just, I don't know, I think there's a tendency which I try to target a few times in the book, or just pick away at a few times in the book, of lumping everyone together and just saying the Romans were callous. The Romans didn't care about life, you know, didn't care about infant deaths and things like that. And you just think, no, you can't do this. People are diverse. They always have been. And there may have been, well, there would have been some callous individuals, because there always are some callous individuals, but there would have been people who were really desperately upset by losing their children. And even, you know, even desperately upset by having to commit infanticide because they couldn't support another baby in the family. So I think it's really important that we don't do that kind of, you know, easy characterization and stereotyping of people in the past, because we shouldn't be doing it in the present either. And I think just because they're in the past, it doesn't mean that it's okay to do it.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it's absolutely fascinating stuff. It's sort of having to step aside and be a scientist, but also maintain your humanity. It sort of shows it's not possible to look at a baby skeleton and not be affected by the story that you're seeing. But all the things you're working with are someone dying, basically, aren't they? All of these stories by necessity are about something, you know, and it might be an old age and it might not be a tragic death, but it's a, you know, I mean, all deaths are to some extent tragic, but it might not be an unexpected death. But it's still, you're still dealing with a human life, and I think once you realize that's the job, as you say, the same if it's a crime as well, that you have to do your job and work out what's happened. It's what can be learnt from those things, and it's amazing. And I don't know, you talk about the and not, again, in a similar vein, not kind of presupposing gender of the buried person due to what's buried with them.
Yeah,
Which again, is quite a difficult, that's a quite a difficult prejudice to overcome. And obviously there are some elements where military, well, isn't that interesting that there was a suggestion that all men were buried with the same kind of weapons, regardless of whether they were military or not, but that was a sign of their masculinity, possibly if they had a sword and a knife.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So talked to Hugh Wilmot about his Anglo-Saxon burials, particularly at Scrembe, and he's brilliant, Hugh. I mean, he's a wonderful archaeologist. He just puts things in a very accessible way, and you can, it's not kind of highfalutin, and he he's done things like really kind of open my eyes to, I think I, you know, I would have looked at a grave with lots and lots of brooches in it and thought, oh, that's somebody that's really high status. And he said, no, hang on a minute. What if they're buried in the winter? Because if they're buried in the winter, they're clearly being buried. These Anglo-Saxon burials, you know, sort of mid-millennium, people are being buried fully clothed. And sometimes you just find, you know, maybe two brooches at the shoulders of a woman. But sometimes, you know, there's like up to five brooches. And he said, I don't necessarily think this is about status. It's probably that she's wearing a cloak and then maybe something else over the top of that. And it's all pinned through with the brooches. And you think, oh, yeah, okay, hang on. There is a much more mundane explanation. Or not more mundane, just an alternative explanation.
Yeah.
And then his, yeah, his thing about the kind of warrior status, because there did seem to be this very, you know, this thing in Anglo-Saxon society that as a man, you expressed your masculinity. And you just, you had these things which were emblems of your masculinity, and just lots of people get buried with a spear and a shield. And he said, look, I don't think this means everybody's a warrior, or that everybody has even, you know, used those weapons, you know, in just the occasional skirmish. It is just that that's what you have in the cupboard. So that is your, you have it, so you're ready. And then when you're buried with it, because it's very personal. So it was really interesting talking to him about, you know, what those, about the meanings of those objects.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's so difficult to step aside from your own presumptions and, you know, for anyone, but that's the job, is that you have to be so open-minded to not, and to re-examine what past thought was as well. That I think that I find it interesting that it's an ever-changing discipline, and that language changes, and that, I mean, obviously within this book, the kind of main thesis at the end is to question whether our idea that we're all taught in primary school, and I remember being taught in primary school, of all the different the Jutes and the Saxons and everyone coming in and taking over different, and it being a big battle and an invasion, because that's what is the Venerable Bede, is it, who says that, who I had to study at university but didn't. That's why I'm questioning it. And your thesis in this is it's a much more sort of peaceful, gradual process of people being welcomed in, or, you know, were asked to come and or just turning up.
I mean, it's not really my thesis. It's kind of what's happening in archaeology at the moment, and a real kind of questioning of that very neat story, which, you know, is lovely and neat, and it kind of explains the kind of change in language that we see in Britain, and it explains the change in culture, where we do see culture that's more linked to kind of Northwest Europe rather than Mediterranean Europe. Or actually, when you look at it closely, I mean, this is the interesting thing, is when you look at it closely, even that turns out to have been, you know, to be a massive oversimplification. You can still see plenty of Mediterranean culture coming in too. But it does it, like, I mean, Susan Oosthuizen has been a real proponent of again, just putting the history to one side and having a look at the archaeology and seeing what the archaeology says. You know, does the archaeology say that there's a massive discontinuity, particularly in land use? You know, is there a break in agriculture, which means that you've got, you know, one group of people being slaughtered or moving off somewhere else and another group of people coming in? We just don't really seem to see that at all. So it's possible that there's a change in high politics, that there are and it may not even be different leaders coming in. It might be essentially the same leaders and the same kind of elite families who've held dynastic power in the Roman Empire, still in power, but reorienting their allegiances. So as they leave the Roman Empire, they are switching to more allegiances with Northwest Europe. So with those kind of classically Germanic countries, or, you know, states, the other side of the North Sea. So I think that's a really interesting explanation for what's going on. And it means that there's a kind of, that it's more of a political shift than a kind of population shift. But we're still, I mean, we will find out more about this when we get some more information coming through from genetics. So when my friends at the Crick Institute in London process more of their genomes from this millennium, we'll get a much clearer picture of what kind of influx there was from the continent during this millennium, because there clearly is influx. We're not, you know, nobody's saying nobody came over the North Sea into Britain at that point. But what we don't know, actually, is whether the influx is bigger in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries than it was, for instance, in the Roman period, when we know we've got loads of people coming over the North Sea. We've got, you know, masses of Roman auxiliaries, for instance, coming from those kind of Germanic homelands. So those are kind of questions that archaeology on its own hasn't been able to answer, and where genetics can actually come along and go, right, let's have a look at the genomes of people who are around in the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries. And are they substantially different than the people who were there in the Roman period? Or does it look like we've mostly got the descendants of those people with a few more people coming over? And they'll be able to actually quantify how much of an influx there was. And the other thing, of course, is there's always an efflux as well. So it's not just immigration, there's emigration happening at the same time. We always seem to focus in Britain on people coming to us and ideas coming to us, even in the modern day, obviously. And we kind of forget about the people who are leaving Britain and going to settle elsewhere.
That which still happens today, and they still get to vote, even though they're living in Spain. But that's lovely. It is interesting the modern parallels that come out because of that Europe thing, and obviously going back to the incredible human journey, we all come from the same place anyway, and so it's kind of crazy. The idea of being British is crazy enough anyway, but when you look at this period and see the influx of where people are coming from, and and you make a good, very good points about the language and where that connects to us in the continent as well. And I love the way that archaeology and genetics can sort of prove the lie in a history. You know, we take all these historians at their word, and obviously most historians are at the very least prejudiced just from writing from their own point of view, so that you can catch people in their own lie as a result of this 1,000-year-old evidence that's just lying under the ground. You go, here you go, but no, look, here's the evidence. So it's interesting. You compare, you know, obviously you've worked in crime, but it is sort of solving crimes that are 1,000 or 2,000 years old. I was disappointed in Buried Ancestors had two chapters, one about the Pocklington discoveries and one about the Cheddar Man. And I was born in Pocklington and grew up in Cheddar.
Oh, brilliant.
And so I kind of thought, oh, good. She's mainly writing about stuff that will apply to me. There's nothing in this book from anywhere that applies to me. But I'm very excited. It was very nice to read about Cheddar Man.
Oh, you'll have to give me a list of places to include in Crypt.
Loughborough. I lived in Loughborough for a bit. Shepherd's Bush. If you could do Loughborough, Shepherd's Bush, Hertfordshire. Hertfordshire, there must be some stuff around Hertfordshire now. I live in Hertfordshire, so that'll be good.
I'll try and dig something out for you, Richard.
Thank you. I don't want to give all the book away anyway, but I thought the chapter about the beheaded corpses was very interesting, that there's lots of burials with the heads placed elsewhere, and whether it's criminals or whether it's... But talking about it being possibly, you know, to stop people coming back from the dead to haunt people,
that's amazing. There's all these medieval stories about that, and it's tricky because they are kind of later medieval. They're not the peak in these beheaded burials, it all comes to a head in the late Roman period, and they're just really odd. They're really odd. So you have skulls which are detached and then sometimes put back on the shoulders in the grave. And then there's lots and lots of them where the skulls are put down by the feet or between the knees. So there's definitely something going on, but trying to work out what it is, a real kind of really, you know, lovely investigation. And some of it is going to be criminal. Some of it will be criminal execution. Some of it will be conflict, undoubtedly. But there do seem to be other interesting things going on where there are heads being carefully detached. And I don't think that is evidence of beheading as the cause of death. I think that's probably heads being detached after death, where you hope it is anyway. and then you just wonder what on earth is going on there. So I think there's potentially a kind of an almost kind of benign ritual element to it as well. And then within some of the beheadings, you do wonder whether there is this kind of late beheading going on, which is talked about in the medieval period, where you get bishops saying, yeah, go and this corpse that has been coming to life every night and terrorizing the village, go and dig it up and chop the head off. You know, we've got documentary evidence of that being, you know, that being a way of exorcising those revenants, those zombies. So you wonder if that goes right back into the Roman period, but it's difficult because we don't have any direct Roman links to that.
But then again, it is something that links to the modern, you know, that idea still has come down to us, even in those zombie stories. So that a zombie, if you want to stop a zombie, you'd have to cut its brain stem or hit it in the brain.
That
whatever that is, there's still an echo of it somewhere in our culture. Yeah. So it is, I found that, really fascinating. I'm delighted. I was going to ask if you're going to carry on and take us up to date and maybe just start digging up people who've just died in the last couple of years. Yeah. See how things are going. See how they did things back in 2018 or something.
Yeah, dig
up a few of those.
I don't think I'd be particularly keen to dig up very fresh graves, but I mean, I've looked at some fairly recent cemeteries. We filmed at the terminals of HS2 when they were digging the cemeteries there. In order to expand the terminus at Euston and then at Park Street in Birmingham. And that involved the removal of thousands, absolutely thousands of burials in London and Birmingham. And obviously they're all very carefully archaeologically excavated and then the remains will be reburied elsewhere. But those were extraordinary sites to visit while they were being dug. And I made a series for BBC2 about that, which I think was called The Biggest Dig, and that was really interesting because then you can link up individuals with biographies, because particularly in London there were coffin plates on the on the coffins, so you've got actual named individuals who you can actually then trace historically, so that's fascinating too. So and there were some quite those cemeteries were kind of mid 17th through to mid 19th centuries, I think, or mid 18th through to mid 19th.
It's amazing, and please carry on. I mean, you're not going to stop, so please carry on doing this, Professor Alice Roberts. They're brilliant books. I do recommend both of them. Do if you haven't read Ancestors, read that. And I mean, you can read Buried without reading Ancestors, but let's sell you two books at once. Get Ancestors as well, and buy all of Alice's fantastic books. And I would recommend the audiobooks because it's fantastic having you read them and beautifully pronounce
painstakingly
Scottish islands.
I'm going to get loads of people right. I'm going to get loads of Gaelic speakers right. Not quite right, actually, Alice.
Brilliant. Look, thanks so much for talking to us, and thank you for writing these books. They're absolutely fascinating and brilliant. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Alice Roberts. We're going to be back next week, I think, with Stephanie Merritt talking about her book Storm, her novel Storm. So do tune in for that. And thank you to Chris Evans for all his hard work on the show. He just cut me off. No, he hasn't. Good. Thank you, Alice. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show. If you enjoyed it, if you want to see me, that'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.